Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, the team discusses a story prompting questions about how state departments follow the Freedom of Information Act after documents from an email chain concerning Benton Harbor's drinking water displayed a message in Greek characters. Director Peter Berg of Michigan State University School of Human Resources and Labor Relations describes how, with a UAW strike looming, he does not see a sky is falling scenario right now. And freshman state rep Donovan McKinney explains some Democratic priorities beyond the scope of the governor's What's Next address. Now here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber, editor Kyle Malin, executive reporter Andrew Miniger, House reporter Danielle James, and MERS publisher, the boss, John Rurick.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast, which we have pre-recorded ahead of the Labor Day weekend. I hope everyone who's listening experienced safe travels and hopefully some fantastic Michigan sunshine. Later, we'll be discussing the looming possibility of a historic UAW strike and speaking with freshman rep Donovan McKinney on a new week for state lawmakers. But to get things rolling, we are with MERS editor Kyle Malin, executive reporter Andrew Miniger, and MERS publisher, the boss, John Rurink, to talk about a story that's provoking questions about state departments possibly going around the Freedom of Information Act as an email chain related to lead levels in Benton Harbor's drinking water appeared in federal civil court documents with Greek characters on display. Andy, as someone who wrote our initial story on the topic, can you explain what exactly is going on here and why does it matter?
So there's a couple different explanations for what happened. One of the explanations is that somebody had taken the characters that were as written and changed them into a different font. Another explanation is that they were copied and pasted out of a word processing document into an email. And because of that, there was a glitch that happened. And they returned characters of Greek lettering, which it's not Greek language. It's all English. But the problem is that none of this is searchable in a FOIA format. So if you're searching for the word Flint, which appeared in the missive or the email, then it would not return because that is in Greek characters. So the argument is that it is trying to skirt or go around a FOIA in a coded language. And this is what kind of has sparked this debate. And the whole idea of my story was initially about how do different places, whether it's state departments or different universities, how do they try to skirt FOIA? And all of them do it, regardless of what it is. All of them are looking at ways in which they can redact or delay, or do other things to kind of play with the language of the Freedom of Information Act.
You know, and I just want to reiterate that, you know, the message that we are referring to is from Andrew Levitt, a multi-client lobbyist and partner for Corn Johnson Levitt. And in this email, it ultimately said, fresh off the presses, as I warned, there are some major red flags. It feels like we are back at square one, having not learned much from Flint. Ultimately, it says if you view this email via cell phone, you see it in the actual English language. If you view it via email, it appears to be in Greek letters. Kyle, that seems like a pretty big message to have that type of mess up happen with, though, isn't it?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Sam. I mean, if the message was, oh, hey, I can't respond to this right now, I'm on vacation, nobody would have thought twice about it, because then it'd be like, oh, yeah, this was obviously some kind of coding mix up. But the fact that this came from Andrew Levitt, who has experience with the Flint water crisis, having worked with former Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick, former Congressman Dan Kildee, during the time of the Flint water crisis, he has experience on this. And for him to kind of flag the situation in Benton Harbor and kind of equate the two is a pretty significant statement to come out with. And so that's why I think that there is a healthy skepticism about why this appeared in some type of code. Now, my understanding is that this was an innocent mistake. This is the information that we've been told, that that Andy just basically cut and pasted something off of a Microsoft document, put it into a Word program, and for some people it came out Greek in Greek lettering. And in the FOIA, the person who put together the FOIA responses on that person's computer, it also came out in Greek. Which, you know, is easily explainable. However, given the message and given who it came from, it does elicit some healthy skepticism from people and does raise the question that I think conservative news outlets have jumped to immediately, which is that the Governor Whitmer administration is trying to hide sensitive information from the public by coding it in Greek. The problem with that is that you're assigning intent to somebody when there is no proof that that is exactly what they were trying to do. You're just suspecting that that's what they were trying to do.
Now, John, you did your own experiment with this today, right?
I did, because I'm fascinated by it. During our morning meeting while we were discussing it, I did a Google search on Microsoft and Greek letters turning or English turning to Greek. And I found multiple statements, questions posed in the Microsoft community, where they kind of pose questions and other geeky people kind of answer it. And it was exactly that, where someone took something from a Microsoft Word document, they pasted it, and it appeared as Greek in email. When they then pasted the same text into their notebook application, it was English. Interestingly, though, when I was playing around with this, and I was kind of writing my notes up on this, I actually copied a paragraph from the internet, and this is the quote that I was copying. I ran across this issue a few weeks ago at my company. Seems that a colleague of mine had updated some fonts in the Windows font folder and pushed the change out through GPO. I don't know what that is, which caused erratic behavior, as you have described. But this was just strictly with Microsoft applications, as everything else worked just fine in displaying fonts. Well, when I copied that paragraph and then I pasted it into my Microsoft Word notes, guess what? It automatically changed to this font called Roboto. Roboto, I think it's Rob, like a robot. And it's Greek symbols. You can't read it. It's gobbledygook.
Huh. Wow.
And I actually went, while we were having this discussion, I went to paste it in a text message. And the text message, which is an Apple product, pasted that font that looks like Greek in Microsoft Word as English.
Huh. So exactly what they were saying, huh, John?
Exactly what they were saying.
Wow.
It is a glitch. There are lots of examples out there in discussion forums. This may be a case where, you know, it's just too good of a story to want to find something wrong with it. So we go with the obvious cynical, they're trying to be mean and bad and hide things from us. They're corrupt message, which is, you know, kind of where we're at as a society today. But look, I mean, it took me 10 minutes to replicate the same thing unintentionally. It was a copy. It was a paste from a web page to Microsoft Word, and boom. So, you know, that doesn't mean that they didn't do this to hide information, but it certainly explains that their explanation is legit.
I apologize for some reiteration, but I feel like it's the fact that the message was literally like back to square one with the Flint water crisis, a very emotionally stimulating conversation point, I would dare say. And why did it have to be that specific sentence that gets subjected to the glitch? And I feel like because of that, now we're down a rabbit hole, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, it could have pasted, I want to go to Harry's for lunch.
Yeah. And you know what? But it does raise the question, though, for us, and I'm sure other news media outlets, does this happen often? And I'm sure we're not going to be the first ones to put in FOIAs, or maybe we will be because we're going to be doing it today, but putting in FOIAs to find out, do we have state departments where this has happened before, where there are messages that are written in these types of Greek fonts? And these characters, do they show up anywhere else in a FOIA? And we'll see how common it is. And maybe there are messages like, you know, I got to take some time off for vacation. I mean, maybe we'll find some of those kind of messages written in Greek, and we'll kind of further you know, add credibility to that argument.
So there's an interesting caveat to this that I actually didn't include. That is that Microsoft itself had just updated their entire system to be able to search for Greek characters in July. So before July, you weren't able to search for Greek characters in Microsoft.
Oh, so the State Department then arguably could do these FOIA searches then, is what now. You're saying. They could. Yeah, correct. They could now. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, do you think that maybe this could mean that someone's going to call for a revamping of Michigan's FOIA law to go after these type of technological glitches and these type of errors in the new internet uploading system?
So they already are. There's the Michigan Law Commission, Revision Commission, who has several recommendations already for updating FOIA laws. And they've sent these to the legislator, and they've asked, you know, different people to look at updating all the digital laws for FOIA. Because right now, another thing doesn't return when you ask for FOIA. They don't return anything from Zoom chats, and they don't return anything from Teams messages. And these are all still documents. But again, it's one of those things that really needs to be updated. It hasn't been updated for quite some time.
You know what they should do if there is going to be a revision of FOIA? We should also look into some of the things that you mentioned in your story on Thursday, Andrew, which is dealing with timeframes and how governments are kind of manipulating the timeframes on this and stretching out requests into months and in some cases years before they fill a request. We saw that during, I think, the Flint water crisis under the prior administration. We're seeing it now. And we're also seeing situations, particularly with universities, where reporters get back filled FOIAs that 90 to 95% of it is just redacted stuff. The liberalization of what governments are doing to try and redact FOIAs, I think, is a much bigger issue than this issue that we saw here with the Greek thing, which may just be a one-off. Hopefully it is. But I mean, to really drill down and let the public see what's going on and expanding it to the governor's office, a FOIA to the governor's office has always been talked about. But I think the redaction and the out of control and inconsistency in redaction is a much bigger issue.
You know, at least if you get something sent to you that's in a foreign language, at least you can put it through Google Translate. You can't do that with redaction bars.
Wish you could.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
You know, Kyle, I do want to change topics real quick, if that's all right with you, to discuss a press conference you covered on August 31st, this past Thursday, that was hosted by the Michigan Republican Party, as they want to see ramped up action on a 2020 voter registration fraud case involving GBI strategies. Can you tell us more about the issue and what you're hearing from all parties involved?
So back in 2020, there was an investigation in Muskegon by the Muskegon police into a bunch of voter registrations that were filed pretty close to the general election in 2020. There was an outfit called GBI Strategies that has been hired by the Democrats in the past to try and get additional voter registrations online, to get more voters. And from my understanding and what was reported, the Muskegon clerk's office flagged this as being fraudulent people. It's kind of like the petition circulators for James Craig and Perry Johnson, just a bunch of random names. The addresses didn't match up. The people said that they never asked for this. So the police then turned it over to the state police, and they started doing searches on the an office from GBI Strategies in Southfield, looking for evidence to see if this was a widespread issue with this company, if this was a one-off, or what the situation was. It was referred then to the FBI because GBI Strategies is a national company based in Tennessee. But what the initial investigation found was that this was some low-level individuals who were basically getting paid to get voters to register to vote, and they were trying to pad their pockets, kind of like the petition circulators for Perry Johnson. And so they made up all these voter registrations. The clerk in Muskegon caught it. Nobody got any ballots. None of these people voted. But the Republicans have grabbed onto this as evidence that there was fraud in the 2020 election, and that Democratic administration has not done anything with it. Why were these people not charged? We've got the people in the Perry Johnson and James Craig petition circulator case being charged by the attorney general, but the FBI, who has taken over the case here in Muskegon, has never charged any of these low-level people at GBI Strategies with anything. And so they think that there's obviously some inequity here, and are drumming this up as evidence, again, of fraud in 2020.
You know, I feel like often when we have a pundit on this podcast, they like to say, oh, the Michigan GOP, it's a mess. It's chaos. It's disruption. But now I do wonder, do you think this could be a winning argument for the Michigan GOP?
Well, I think really for the first time, they actually have a decent case to make. I mean, this was a case where there was fraud. It's just not them saying it. They actually have police reports that have investigated this and have found that there was evidence. And it's also true, as far as we know, that nobody has ever been prosecuted in this case. So they are bringing that up. Now, to say that that influenced the results of any election, there is absolutely still no proof of that. But what they are showing is that there are bad actors out there who are doing things. And so then they can use that as a jumping off point into making other claims.
What are your thoughts, Andy?
So my thought is that it seems like on its face, it was caught before there was any big blow up, in contrast to what happened with the five people who were kicked off the ballot during that whole situation. There's a direct cause of harm in one case where there is no harm, something that was caught in the safety net with the other one. Should this absolutely be addressed? Yes. But I think what should be addressed in this situation should be the laws and something done through legislature. I think that this is something that that is obviously a problem with people who are paid. You know, it is something that needs to be addressed overall. And this is now the second time that we've seen something like this.
You know, I feel like a reoccurring phrase here that we especially hear from Republicans is, a two-tiered system of justice, a weaponized justice system. And it seems that this incident from Muskegon is going to get put into a compare and contrast match with the 16 Trump electors when it comes to electoral college certificates that they signed, claiming that Trump won the 2020 election and then sent them over to Congress. What are your thoughts on this attempt to put them in that type of compare and contrast match?
So I can understand why Republicans would say, hey, look, the FBI is not investigating this, but here we have these electors who are getting charged criminally by the attorney general. So, I mean, this is a state issue. The latter is a state issue that state authorities have decided to take care of because the federal government was not going to do it. And you could say, well, the federal government's not doing this, so why isn't the state take care of these Muskegon people? And I think it's the federal government just has not ruled out that it's not going to do anything. I mean, this is a lower level case of fraud that the FBI just has not gotten the time to wrap up yet, is my understanding. And if and when they do, maybe the attorney general comes back with it. But I can understand from a political argument why they would bring up the electors and their frustration here.
I just want to make one point, and not to beat up on the Republican Party, but the problem with the press conference and the problem with the argument and the problem with the comparisons is they're all based around the 2020 election. You have an executive director of a state party who probably spent the better part of a week getting ready for this press conference instead of fundraising, grassroots development, and getting ready for a 2024 election. And it's not just the Michigan Republican Party that has this issue. It's all the way across the board in the United States, vis-a-vis who the front runner is. We're going to be talking about 2020 all the way through 2024. And I think it's going to have the risk of being a very detrimental thing for the Republican Party.
I agree with John on that one.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us on this reporter, MERS reporter roundtable. And again, hope everyone had safe travels following the Labor Day weekend holiday. And again, thank you so much. And let's hear the rest of today's episode.
Αγόρι μου, στολίδι μου, σαν γέρνεις και μ' αγγίζεις.
Joining us now is Peter Berg, a professor of employment relations and director of the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University, to discuss the looming strike by the United Auto Workers. The UAW's contract with General Motors, Stellantis, and the Ford Motor Company are poised to conclude on September 14th. Among the most significant of the UAW's demands is eliminating tiers on wages and benefits, as those in the second tier, meaning they were hired after 2007, earn approximately $16 to $19 per hour, while the first tier acquires about $28 per hour. Additionally, there is a call to boost wages by 46% over 4 years, to instate more paid time off, and within other conversations, to look at potentially instating a 32-hour work week. Peter, from where you stand as a professor and as somebody who would analyze these topics, does it look like a historic strike is ultimately inevitable at this point?
I think a strike, some type of strike, is likely. I think it's likely because of the positioning the UAW has taken in wanting to use its position of relative power right now to use that position and to get roll back some of the concessions they gave earlier to the big three automakers. And I think the strike is being seen as a tool that can help them achieve some of these gains and rollbacks at the bargaining table.
You know, I know that I mentioned some of the demands that the UAW has. Would you mind just kind of going over some of the biggest ones for me and overall talking about what they mean and what could be their long-term impacts?
I think you had mentioned two of them off the top, the eliminating the tiers on wages and benefits. This was a concession that the UAW made when there was a lot of more economic hardship in the auto industry. And it was one that protected existing workers against sort of future workers. Those who would enter at the lower tier. And so at the time, it made sense, I think, for the UAW to agree to this. But over time, those who are entering in the lower tier have increased in employment in the industry and in UAW membership. And it's become, I think, a sore spot within the union that you have people working the same jobs, earning totally different wages. And access to the upper tier takes time to get there. And so this demand, I think, is probably a big priority for the union in rolling that back.
You know, I am a bit curious. I mean, could you speak about what role Michigan plays in all of this, given the fact that there are strong automotive roots here and that we have elected officials who have urgently tried to ensure that the big three both stay and continue to expand in Michigan?
I mean, I think Michigan, what's important for Michigan is to maintain the innovation and skilled workforce for the auto industry as it transitions to more electric vehicles. And I think that what the state can do is work with training programs, incentives for factories to be built, to help ensure that that know-how and that training among the workforce stays within Michigan. This strike and what the UAW is doing, or this looming strike, I think is, I don't think jeopardizes that. I think this is a period of transition where the UAW is looking at resetting its foundation within its contract. And from that foundation, there's going to be, we know there's going to be new investments by the auto companies in electric vehicle technology. And the UAW wants to reset the foundation of their contract and then negotiate going forward on just what would their role be in a more electric-focused auto industry.
From an economic standpoint, you know, what do you view as more fiscally consequential, meeting the UAW's top demands or undergoing what could be a history book worthy strike?
Well, I don't think it's either or. I mean, these demands are often made where the UAW is saying this is what we want. What they may end up with may be different through the collective bargaining process, which often requires some give and take, some back and forth. The strike is a way to exact some cost on companies as a way to get companies to come to a position that's more favorable to the UAW. An effective strike is one that leads to a contract. And so I think the UAW has to decide, how do they want the strike to go? Do they want to strike all three at once? And I can't remember a time when the UAW has done that, all big three companies at once. Do they want to pick one company as a target and use that as a pattern? Or would they do something more targeted action against particular supply plants in, say, one company where they might exact some pain in the ability of having parts supplied that could actually shut down other plants and use a more targeted approach, which might mean fewer members, but also might result in cost to the companies. So I see this as really all part of the collective bargaining process, and we just have to see how it plays out.
You know, I feel like in a lot of the coverage here, there's kind of this sensation of chaos, like, oh, you know, the strike is coming, history book worthy, get your supply chains ready. But one thing I'm kind of noticing about you, Peter, you seem very, very calm right now in your observations. Do you think that there's a little bit of sensationalism going on with coverage?
I do think that it's often the case that we tend to blow some things out of proportion. This, you know, if the strike could be short, it could be long. If this strike goes on for 2-3 months, then there's going to be some real problems. I mean, I think you'll also see the UAW members with income loss, the cost of the companies. But if the strike is more short and the parties come together and realize, okay, we need to form an agreement here, then I think it's more likely to be constructive. Well, I would say part of the bargaining process and strategic. And so I don't necessarily see a sky is falling, it's going to be the be all end all. Right now, I think that remains to be seen.
No, I also want to take a pivot when we talk about the changing personalities of labor organizations. Ultimately, I want to poke your brain on the new face of the UAW, who is Sean Fain, who was deemed as the more progressive candidate and, based on various coverage, the more pro-strike candidate when he was running for the presidency against past president Ray Curry. I mean, how does the change in leadership shuffle the cards here?
I think it's had a huge impact on the UAW's approach. And Sean Fain has really come in and said, we're going to be much more aggressive in bargaining. Now is the time for us to ask for more. And there are conditions that exist right now that give the UAW some additional power in bargaining. We have demand for product within the auto industry remains strong. Companies have seen profits. We have also seen there's some inflationary pressure within the economy, which can lead to the ability of companies to pass on higher labor costs in the form of higher prices. The companies have a greater ability to pay, I think, from the UAW perspective. So I think Sean Fain is saying now is the time to act and to be aggressive. And he's being very aggressive. This is a break from the past in these negotiations. And I think the list of demands that he's made is sort of, we want it all back right now. You know, we want big wage increases, elimination of the two-tier, restoration of some defined benefit pension for workers that don't have it. So that's why I think in some ways the UAW sort of said, in order to remain aggressive, I think a strike is likely as a way of demonstrating this aggressiveness, that we went and did everything we could to get as many of these demands as we want.
You know, I know that MSU, when they were kind of putting you forward as a pundit on this topic, they showed a Bloomberg News report from early August suggesting that UAW contract proposals would add $80 billion in labor costs for each of the biggest U.S. automakers over the length of the contract. Would you mind kind of diving into some of those numbers, those projections of what would be the price tag of if the UAW gets what they want?
You know, I think that these projections often take the extreme position. What if the UAW gets everything they demand? What would the cost be? It's rare that in a collective bargaining environment that one side gets everything that they want. And I think these cost estimates show the boundaries of what that contract is. And the companies are very unlikely to agree to all of the UAW demands, or even maybe some particularly of the cost demands that the UAW wants. But it's where they meet in the middle that really matters. And they will cost that out with their own costing, not the estimates from consultants, their own costing to know exactly where their position is. And I think that's often more relevant. Some of these bigger cost estimates are a bit, I would say, extreme.
I do wonder, thinking about the two-tier discussion that we had, I know that in your capacity at MSU, you also zoom in on working, the aging workforce issue. Now, it kind of seems that eliminating this tier system could be beneficial for companies when we think about labor shortages, when we think about less people going into the automotive industry. I wonder if this elimination can also be used as an enticement tool for the younger generation of workers.
I mean, I think you're correct here that the auto industry is the prime employer. It's a manufacturing environment. Those wages in the lower tier compete with other industries. They're not premium wages per se that used to be the case in the auto industry. So to secure a workforce of the future, it could very well be that the companies are saying, yeah, you know, we've got to pay more, but then also maybe do some things on the conditions of work, allow for more flexibility with the way workers in the auto industry work. So that's another thing I would hope that they would be considering, because these jobs need to be attractive to Michigan workers, and we want workers going into those jobs. But I think those jobs need to be seen as premium jobs and attractive jobs for folks.
Now, the Anderson Economic Group, which is based in East Lansing, they estimated that a work stoppage by nearly 150,000 UAW workers at GM, Ford, and Stellantis would cost more than $5 billion after 10 days. And what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, none of this is guaranteed to unfold. We don't really know what's going to happen. That estimate is done as if every worker walks out in every company, all of the big three. And I can't remember a time when that's done. Again, I think that's an estimate that goes to the extreme as a way to have an eye-popping number that this is really, really costly. What the impact of the strike on each automaker is more likely to be calculated on what are they going to lose per day. And again, the strike could be targeted. It could be on one company. We don't know that yet. So once we have a sense of how the strike is, I think you'd see other calculations going, okay, let's do what's the cost per day to the companies or per week if this happens, if one company is struck or these several plants are struck, and then we'll know exactly what the strategy is in the UAW.
Do you have any personal predictions at this point in time?
No, I don't have any personal predictions. I'm not talking to Sean Fain and getting the insights there. I haven't read anything that gives me an indication to say it's going to be one way or the other. I think right now it's anybody who's saying they know probably is guessing.
Do you believe that state governments are preparing for some sort of huge economic turmoil because of this? Is that something that you've noticed?
I think the state government would look at this and say, okay, let's see how this plays out, whether it's going to be short or long. And if it goes on and on and on, then I think you would start to, politicians may begin to reach out to the parties and just say, you know, where are you at and what's going on? We notice maybe some folks are certainly out of the labor market, or they're sitting on the sidelines, they're losing income, then that becomes a concern. But right away, I don't think initially that the state government would probably be involved in that right away.
I guess I am a little bit curious. If you had to describe the current state of where things are in the market, in the automotive industry, I mean, what would be your illustration?
The auto companies right now, I think, want to be and are looking to set up a workforce for their future as they look ahead in electronic vehicles. there are workers there who've come out of the internal combustion engine, and that's a lot of what the UAW does. The UAW is going to want to talk about transitions for workers as well with plants. But for the companies, they're going to look at where can I find the talent to move into the future? And this is where, as I said before, state government can be particularly helpful in fostering the training needed for those kinds of workers. I think the labor market in Michigan can do that. I think we have the capacity to do that and to be that place. So I think the labor market right now for auto companies is solid, but really needs to be focused on that future.
I have heard conversations of like auto manufacturers are ramping up production because they need to get it done now before the strike happens. Or, you know, I've heard the conversation of like, oh, you know, if you're going to get a car, like you better like hurry up. And just kind of overall those looming, what should you do? What should you not do? How quick are cars being built right now because of this strike conversation? Is there kind of some truth to those chats?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a strategy that companies would always do if there's a strike that's looming. They've probably been ramping up production for a long time. You want to build inventory so that you can sustain your product in the midst of a strike. So I would imagine the companies are sitting on a lot of inventory right now that'll help them be able to deliver the product. You know, how long they can do that, I don't know. But that's very common approach. And I would imagine the companies have been doing that for a while.
But doesn't ramping up production, wouldn't that further burnt out workers and make them more angry going into the strike?
It depends how they do it. You know, if they're working people overtime, if people are getting paid overtime, some people love that. So that isn't a source of anger. Sometimes it's people feeling like, well, it's just, you know, if I'm on the lower tier and I know I'm working, they may feel that it's just an insult to do more work at those lower wages. So they may be more jazzed to get some of this done. But for auto workers, having work is good. And even though they know they're building up inventory, which can impact the effectiveness of the strike.
And what would you really want to share as people learn about this looming strike, as people make their own speculations and projections?
I think what I'd say is that there's sort of two things going on here, that while we are very focused on right now, the UAW contract negotiations, the possibility of a looming strike, all the demands the UAW is making, I think this is sort of one piece of the auto story. And I think I would put it, as I'd said before, the UAW wanting to set the foundation in a contract over the next 4 years of these are the conditions we want to work under going forward into the future. That's the second part. What is the future of the industry? The future is going to look different than the current situation. Auto companies are engaging in new facilities. They're engaging in partnerships with other companies around battery production, around electronic car production. That's going to be the future. And so just focusing on this one aspect of this contract negotiation without considering its implication of the future, I think can be a little bit too narrow. And that's what I would emphasize, that we look at, okay, what did the UAW achieve when this gets sorted out? And what did the companies agree to? And how does this set up the companies and the workers for the future of the industry?
But what would be the first thing that you would see? What would be the first symptom of a strike that the everyday person would notice?
Okay, so it's going to depend on how extensive the walkout is, who's walking out and where. It will depend on, can people get access to cars? So that would be the first thing, or trucks. And they'll say, okay, am I able to buy the product that I want? Well, if inventories are such that they can do that, they may not notice it. But then eventually, they may begin to notice it. The other is dealerships, will they have product to sell you? Will they have people there and their own people that they employ will begin to notice it? I think people in their local communities, if you're striking and you have a local community that has a factory in it, that can often have a big impact on the community. So local communities will begin to see that impact as well as their workers go out on strike and they're getting paid with strike funds or using their savings. So those are things we tend to see and people to feel right away. I think it really depends, again, where the strike is. If it's a massive strike, that all three companies, there's a walkout, that's going to have a lot bigger implications, and we'll feel it a lot more than if it's targeted.
Now, what is the strike pay right now for the UAW that the UAW has stored?
That they have strike funds in there. I saw one estimate said, you know, depending if they strike all three, they might have 11 weeks of strike funds available. But that's, again, guesswork on a big, big strike. So it tends not to, it doesn't cover the whole wage of workers. They would have to dip into their savings for sure.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Peter, for joining us today on the MERS Monday podcast for our Labor Day episode. Everybody, that was Peter Berg, a professor of employment relations and director of the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Before we begin our final segment, an interview with Democratic State Rep Donovan McKinney of Northeast Detroit, conducted by myself and MERS's House reporter Danielle James, I would like to disclose that we conducted this interview on August 27th, ahead of the governor's What's Next vision-setting address for fall of 2023. With us today for the MERS Monday podcast is State Representative Donovan McKinney, a Democrat representing Centerline in Macomb County, part of Warren and Northeast Detroit. 2023 marks his first year of being a state lawmaker, and he presently serves as the majority vice chair for the House's Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy Eagle Appropriations Subcommittee and the Corrections Appropriations Subcommittee. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rep. McKinney.
Thank you. I'm happy to be joining with you all this morning. I know it's early morning Sunday, but I think with all of our schedules, I just appreciate the flexibility. Glad to be here.
I'm under the impression that this has been a summer of Democratic-led listening tour events, policy-related roundtable discussions, and preemptive election efforts as Democrats will try to retain the state house in 2024. Based on interactions with voters, what policy proposals do you think that they would be most upset, furious about if they don't get passed by the end of this year, the end of 2023?
That's a great question. And there's so many things that I'm working on, especially in my neck of the woods, in my community. And I've been hearing from them, like me and Senators Stephanie Chang and Rosemary Bayer and a few other folks, we're pushing a water affordability package. It's going to be the first of its kind on a state level in U.S. history. So we're working on it right now. We're going to be probably hopefully dropping some bills pretty soon as we come back in right after Labor Day. And it's some good policy stuff. And it's in ensuring that we're able to, because we believe water is a human right, and ensuring that everybody has access to clean and affordable water is key. Another thing that we're working on, I have something called, you know, the pay up bills. It's myself and a few others in the House. I think we got a couple senators. And it's dealing with utility accountability, dealing with, you know, a lot of our recent storms that are hitting and dealing with climate change. How do we kind of mitigate the crisis and how we ensure people are able to weather their storm through ensuring that they're compensated once their power's out? Couple other things, too. One is some police accountability stuff we're working on. Simple lifts like setting up a statewide database for officers to ensure that those officers who take advantage of the badge aren't necessarily going from community to community, hopping around, and ensuring that they're liable for their actions. I want to say those are the three. Oh, the climate package too. We're doing a My Healthy Climate package. Pahuski, Majority Floor Leader Abraham Ayash, a few other folks, my colleagues Jen Hill and Stephanie Chang in the Senate. You got Jeff Irwin. I mean, so many people are working on this climate package, and it's really trying to mitigate the climate crisis that is here and near and dear to our hearts that we're experiencing pretty often in our communities. I mean, we just went through a huge round of storms over the past 3 days, and we've got people who are basements are flooded right now. especially downriver communities in Wayne County, but on the northeast side and the lower east side in my community and leading into Macomb County, they were hit too. You know, people lost power, people's basements are flooded right now. And so ensuring that we're able to mitigate the climate crisis is huge. So I'll leave it there. I feel like I'm rambling, but yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, I would be remiss not to mention kind of the ongoing conversation about an early signing die, lawmakers adjourning early for the year. So various policies that were signed into law that did not receive the necessary immediate effect support can be implemented at an appropriate time. I do have to ask, you know, with there being so many things that you want to see done, so many packages that you're working on, how present are those early signee-die conversations in your mind?
It's present. There are talks about it. We haven't really confirmed if it's going to happen or not. You know, stay tuned. I know there's been reports out saying that we're going to do it. I don't think there's been any confirmation from what I'm hearing. And I'm sure you guys will be probably the first to know as the press, because you all have your eyes and ears on the ground. But we do have some things that need some, that didn't get immediate effect, that needs to take effect. And so this could be a tool to ensure that we're allow those policies to come into play. But outside of that, you know, we have so many things on our plate, and, you know, we're turning towards not just this fall, looking into next year and how we get these policies over the hump.
I sort of want to circle back around to some of the energy policy we were talking about a second ago, specifically the My Power for All plan that several House Democrats recently announced. Could you tell us a little bit about your bill within that package, House Bill 4840?
Yeah, House Bill 40, that's a good question. House Bill 4840 is a package with my colleague Adam Marquette, the only Democrat we have in the Upper Peninsula, Jen Hill, amazing colleague. And she's really intuitive and understands this issue. And so my bill, practically what it does is ensures that low to moderate income people across our communities, across the state, are allowed to participate in this clean energy transition. And so it provides rebates for folks who are looking at making those investments in their homes for battery and or solar storage, and ensures that, you know, once they make those investments, they're allowed some credits, and we're trying to work with the federal government to leverage some funds from them to bring into our state to be kind of like a pass through to ensure that people are getting the funding they need to take advantage of this clean energy transition. Because right now, I believe we have like a 1-2% cap for rooftop solar and things of that nature. And people who are taking advantage of a lot of these rebates and investments, and it's going to lower your utility costs overall. It's also huge when there's a power outage and you're able to have some type of storage to sustain through short-term loss of power. And so, but folks who are taking advantage of this aren't necessarily from my community. They don't necessarily look like me. And so the vast majority of folks who already took advantage of the 1-2% cap that we have currently are, you know, out, you know, west side of the state, some parts of the state, but not necessarily in, you know, those Black and brown communities, those poorer communities that are overburdened when it comes to power outages because the infrastructure isn't necessarily up to par.
We're talking a little bit about the kind of coming back in the fall and the rush to get everything, you know, done as soon as possible. I'm curious, you know, we've heard a lot about energy policy and the role it will take in shaping your caucus when we get back. You know, is there a consensus within the House Democratic Caucus on this policy at this point?
Yeah, no, there's some consensus. I think we need to get it done. And the governor and the lieutenant governor have been doing press conferences. And I was able to join along with our lieutenant governor, Garland Gilchrist, and a few other legislators. Was it not too long ago? I lose track of days because every day is just jam-packed. But I think it was like 2 weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. We were doing a press conference. Our lieutenant governor even talked about how dire it is and how we need to leverage these federal dollars and make sure that Michigan is the center of this clean energy transition.
Now, Rev. McKinney, I mean, you've illustrated how during the February ice storms, your family needed to stay in a hotel with your baby boy as power outages occurred. And correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, some of your constituents died during this period, right?
Yes, that's so true. And, you know, fortunately, I haven't had any reports of people dying this past storm, but this has been a long road. It hasn't just been a short term issue. It's been a long-term issue. What's going on in the city of Detroit in particular, in the surrounding area, but more so focused on the city of Detroit, is that our power lines and you know, DTE has been, they've come to the Energy Committee in the House, chaired by Helena Scott, in Lansing, and they've come to different hearings, and they even admit, like, we have old infrastructure. We have power lines in operation from the 1910s, and that's on record. But in reality, from what I'm hearing, is it's a little older, and it's over 100 years ago, and they're still in operation. No wonder why our power keeps going out. But to your point about my family, my neighborhood in particular, we've, since my son, he's 19 months old, my wife and I, we had a son, was it January 21st, 2023 is his, or 2022 is his birthday. And so he just recently turned 19 months about a week ago. And the day we brought him home from the hospital, we had a 4-day power outage. And so, you know, he had to spend his first 4 days on this planet in the hotel room. And if you can imagine what my wife was going through after she gave birth, you know, she's still in the healing process. And, you know, we went straight home, and we came in, and it was freezing. We're like, oh, let's turn on the heat. Let's turn on the lights. Nothing. And so I had to go book a hotel room. And, you know, what's going on, too, is when there's high demand for hotel rooms, when there's mass outages, or certain swaths of the state is out of power, they want to tend to, you know, go where there's power. There's hotels, motels. And what do hotels do in those businesses? They increase the rates because the demand is so high. So we have to pay, I believe, $400 a night to stay for those 4 nights. I think total like $1,700, which is unbelievable. And at that time, if you look at what the MPSC, which is our Michigan Public Service Commission, I think in the rules, what they were trying to do, I think it was a $25 credit for, you have to be out for at least a consecutive 96 hours in order to receive the credit. And we applied for the credit and never got it. And so that is literally the story that I hear time and time again in our communities, is that with these prolonged outages, we don't even get the small credit that we're, you know, supposed to get. And I think right now the MPSC increased it from $25 to $35. However, you know, you have to be out for a certain period of time. We got some bills right now that says, hey, if your power goes out for at least 12 hours or 24 hours, you know, you should be compensated. You know, we got some bills that says $200. I want $200. After 24 hours of power outage, I want to give people $200 per day that your power is out. Is that ideal? No, because it will, you know, somewhat bankrupt DTE a little bit. That's what I'm hearing. But in reality, I think there's some appetite to ensure that we increase some compensation for folks who are literally going through prolonged outages. And I have the means, and I'll say this, and we can head to the next topic, is that I have the means to put my family into a hotel. But the people I represent, if you look at the median income in my community, it's about $40,000. And so a lot of them are living check to check. They don't have the resources to go into a hotel room, to be able to stay into a motel and you know, really enjoy power. And in reality, they're going to have to suffer those days that they're without power at home. And so that's when people lose their medication, they lose their food. They, you know, we got seniors on oxygen tanks who aren't necessarily getting, they have to plug it up and who aren't actually getting the oxygen they need. And I know personally a couple of members in my community who have passed away from prolonged power outages. Now, DTE, we've been in communication with DTE as legislators. They've been pretty good at, you know, troubleshooting some of the seniors that are reported to our office and ensuring that they're on the top of the list in terms of getting their power back on. But this is going to continuously happen. No matter how long it's going to take in terms of getting some legislation and policy done in Lansing, it's going to take time to come to fruition. It's going to take time to implement. So in the meantime, while we're going through these storms, while we're continuously being hit hard by extreme weather, there's going to be more power outages because this weather is becoming more extreme, more dangerous, and it's happening more often. So in the meantime, what do we do? What do we do? And yeah.
No, I apologize to interrupt, but yeah. As long as you know, utilities
legislation and what could be the potential solution. Is there a state that kind of, in your mind, holds the gold standard? Or do you feel like every state in the country is now practicing a game of trial and error?
Trial and error, in my opinion. I mean, there's pros and cons in each state. You know, in terms of the Midwest, I think from what I'm hearing, Illinois has a good structure. But if you look at states like Texas, I think Florida, that has unregulated energy flow, they have issues too. So it's not just a Michigan issue with power outages. But what happens with Michigan is that because we continuously get hit hard with storms, and we're like one of the least reliable, we're also one of the most expensive and so in the country. And so there's a give or take. Like, if you're going to continuously take people money and shut folks off when they don't have the money to pay, and then when they are able to pay it, you don't necessarily turn them on as fast as they should. And so we just got some issues. We need to work together. And I appreciate our chairwoman of energy in the House, Helena Scott. She's been doing listening tours across the state. But like I said before, any policy we come up with in Lansing is going to take time to implement. What can we do right now to try to mitigate the crisis and provide some relief for people and lift some of that burden off of them? That's what people are focused on. They understand we got old infrastructure. They're willing to give us time to try to fix it. But what are we going to do to ensure that they're able to get put up in a hotel room while, you know, their power's out for 3 or 4 days? What are we going to do to ensure that they're able to, you know, are able to replace their groceries or even their medicine that they lose in these power outages? And to some degree, their lives. Like, it's sad to say, but we do have people who are dying. It's not happening every day, but it has happened. And I just don't want people to continuously suffer when we have the means to come together, to bring utilities, to bring legislators together and really work on this and provide some relief to people.
You know, I don't want to change the subject on you, but it seems like you've just been involved with so much. I want to be able to touch on, you know, a little bit of everything. But one of the packages that I've been keeping an eye on in the last few weeks, at least, is your recently introduced mobile home parks package. Could you tell me a little bit about that slate of bills and, you know, what you're intending to accomplish with them?
Yeah, for sure. So the industry, and I got to give a shout out to Senator John Cherry. He's been working on this for years. And essentially, there's a divide between the industry, the people who actually own the mobile home parks, and then the advocates on the ground who actually live in the mobile parks. And so how I got involved is because I represent some portions of Macomb County, Southern Macomb County, and Warren and Centerline, I have a lot of trailer parks in my district, mobile home parks. So I have about 12 altogether, and I have the 8 Mile corridor. So if you know anything about the 8 Mile movie and Eminem, I actually represent the trailer park that Eminem grew up in. So, and while I was knocking doors last summer campaigning, I knocked on some of these doors and I've been in some of these lots and trailer homes and mobile homes. And I'm like, wow, the conditions are, you know, it's really sad the way people are living in some of these mobile home parks, and they're subjected to so many crises. And right now what's going on, especially in the city of Warren, they're trying to regulate some of the things that are happening in these trailer homes, because some of these like mobile homes themselves have mold in them. Some of them, you know, especially the water, they're not allowed to regulate the water on a local level. So part of this package, and industry agrees with it, the advocates on the ground agree with it, is that we need some reform. So we're trying to reform the Department of Licensing, so LARA, essentially, to put some rules together and really come down hard on these like lot owners who really don't do anything to improve anything, any of the conditions in the mobile home parks. And so that's where these bills come from. And, you know, we're in negotiations right now. So I'm not sure where it's going to end. I know on one side, they kind of want rent control because they're allowing folks, especially these owners, to increase your lot rent. Even though you might own the mobile home itself, you're on a lot and they're increasing it literally every few months, sometimes every few weeks. And so it can increase by anywhere between 50 to 100% within a year. And so some folks might get lured into the mobile home park and say, hey, you know what? Lot rent is $300, which is affordable to most folks, the vast majority of the people. But then it increases to $450 and then $600 and then $1,000 within the span of 2 years. You're like, whoa, what happened? And it takes money to move your actual mobile home out of the park and move it somewhere. You know, we have to ensure that there's, you know, some regulation across the board and that people aren't necessarily getting taken advantage of, if that makes sense.
You know, there seems to just be like a huge desire to get a lot done, not just by the end of this year, but by the end of the current legislative term that concludes at the end of 2024. As someone who's kind of involved in the leadership team of Michigan House Democrats, you know, election efforts to retain the state house next year, what are you imagining the session agenda and calendar to look like next year?
That's a good question. I'm hoping we can get a budget done early so we can go campaign and maintain and hopefully expand the majority. But everything is up in the air. So we don't know what's going to look like. You know, things can happen. Crises can come into play that can switch everything. So I can't really predict what's going to happen. But what I can say is that we have a one seat majority in both the House and Senate. We have a Democratic governor, you know, executive, which is our LG or Secretary of State, AG, State Board of Education, Supreme Court, you name it. First time in 40 years, we have a trifecta in the Michigan legislature with the governor. And we do not want to lose it. And Republicans, and I don't know if you know this, I'm the only Democrat that sits on the Republican side of the aisle on the House floor. So I represent the one seat majority. And I hold court with a lot of these Republicans. They got to know them as human beings. Most of them aren't bad human beings. You know, they just have different policy agendas and they have different ideas on how to, you know, solve issues. But a lot of times you can kind of find common ground. But what they're telling me is they're pissed that they don't have a say in our state government, you know. And so first time in four decades. So this is a whole culture shift and regime change they have to get used to. And they're going to fight back. So you got reports that our former governor, Rick Snyder, who I believe personally should be behind bars for what happened in Flint and during his administration. But he's out there raising money with other, you know, rich people, wealthy folks. And they're funding these Republican state reps to figure out how to take back majority. And it's a slim margin. And with these new districts, it's going to be a fight no matter what election cycle it is. It's going to be a fight for the House every single cycle. And, you know, like I said before, this is the first time in 40 years. I think this is the fourth time in history we've held a trifecta since it was recorded in Michigan. And every time we held it prior, we lost the House the following election cycle. And so we do not want tradition to pan out. We want to break tradition. And we're allowed to do that, but we got to fight. We got to fight tooth and nail. We got to show people what we've done with the Democratic majority, which is a lot. And people are calling us the most productive legislature in history. We have to show people what we've done. And if you continuously vote for us and put us in office, you're not going to slow down the momentum. We do not want to slow this down because we have so much to get done, so many investments to make for common people that most of the time for the past 40 years have been left out to dry.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. And I'm so sad because there are so many things I feel like we could talk about for hours.
I know. I could talk forever, man. You know, us public servants, we can go forever.
No, well, thank you so much, Brett McKinney, for joining us on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast.
Yes. I love to come back too. Anytime.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much for the rest of our team here at MERS, editor Kyle Malin, executive reporter Andrew Miniker, house reporter Danielle James, and MERS publisher, the boss, John Ruhrink. Additionally, thank you to director Peter Berg of Michigan State University School of Human Resources and Labor Relations, as well as to Democratic State Rep Donovan McKinney, representing Northeast Detroit, Centerline, and parts of Warren. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bashar Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Schreiber.